Hey there, and welcome to the Confident Woman Podcast. I'm your host, Rachel Brooks. Join me as I sit down and chat with co-hosts, friends, and carefully curated guests and talk about all the things that empower you to become your best and most confident self. So let's get started. All right, ladies, welcome back. So today we have with us Talia Bumbola, the confidence and assertiveness coach and she's also a certified psychodynamic licensed psychotherapist and relationship mentor for women. Her work centers around helping anxious women feel secure by increasing self-worth, confidence, and assertiveness, and rewiring beliefs about themselves. So, of course, we have a lot to talk about because isn't this why we're here? Isn't this why we're on this podcast? We want more confidence. We want to feel valued. We want to increase our self-worth. So who better than to talk about that than Talia? So thank you, Talia, for joining us.
Thank you for having me. When I saw this opportunity, I was very hopeful that it would work out. And so when the guy who works with me helped me to pitch it, I was like, this has to go through because I feel like this would be the perfect message and the perfect platform. So thank you for having me. I'm really excited.
Absolutely. I know that you and I had a chance to connect before, and we've just really align on just what we believe in, the values and the works that we do, and empower your women to really boost and build that confidence, but also sustain it for the long run, right? Because confidence can be wavering. It's one moment we could feel like we got it, and then the next, what happened?
Didn't have that as much as I thought. Okay. Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Exactly. So I'd love for you to share a little bit more about, you know, how you got into the line of work that you're in and all the stuff that you got going on.
Yeah, definitely. So I decided to become a therapist officially after college, unofficially probably when I was growing up in my childhood home, as most therapists do. I realized for myself, I started therapy when I was 13 because I had problems in the school that I was at. It was a small school, like a GATE, Gifted and Talented Education, I think is the acronym. That it was a very small school, and around middle school, when it's already tough, I don't know how many women I've talked to who they're like, that was my first knock on confidence, was when all the hormones were changing. And then we started, like, boys didn't have cooties anymore, and they were actually kind of cute. And then there was this competition. So that was like the perfect storm for me, was going to a small school and having that knock on my confidence because I was being bullied and I felt picked on. So not every time somebody is getting bullied does it affect them. I think sometimes people have a different sense of self. So they're more like Teflon, like I've talked about with my teen clients, and they just let it roll off their back. I unfortunately did not have that self-worth at the time for that to be me. That was not my story. So I started my own therapy as a client way back then. And sometimes those are the only like hour or two a week that I even wanted to be here on earth. Cause again, being in middle school and not fitting in, it was just a lot. And I never would do anything about it, but there was that deep feeling of like, there has to be more than this out there. Like, this can't be the only friend group. This can't be all that's, you know, going to happen. And I was very existential from a young age, so I think that was part of it too. So then I went through high school and college, and then I decided, because I love working with people and I love the human mind, what can I do with the degrees that I have and that I think I would be good at, I think, because I was like the therapist friend. So I decided to go to grad school, and turns out the hunch was correct. And during that process, I learned that there are a lot of cookie cutter templates for different kinds of therapy. And I personally aligned most professionally with psychodynamic and psychoanalytic therapy, which is your unconscious mind, the subconscious. What is the template that you got from childhood? How does your childhood impact your adulthood? If you were or weren't given certain things, will you or won't you expect them? So it's a lot of that deep connection based of, oh, you probably like this because when you were this age, this happened to you. And then people are like, oh, mind blowing. And it really is mind blowing, but it's also about looking at the whole picture. So if you're coming into therapy, let's say, and like, I know for myself, it was obvious what I was going to therapy for. It was obvious what I needed coaching or mentorship for. For some people, it's not as obvious. They kind of have like a buffet menu. They're like, well, this happened, but this also was this. And then this also was this. So being able to practice psychoanalysis, it's not so much that we're only focused on one topic. It's an approach of how to navigate any of the topics that you bring up. It's like a certain lens that we look through compared to other kinds of therapy. So that is why I chose that therapeutic specialization and specializing in confidence and assertiveness with the clients I work with, that really came from my own passion project of understanding what it was like to have confidence, get it taken away, and have to regain it. Like we talked about on when you were on my podcast last week, once you get it taken away and you're climbing that mountain again, and you're learning those skills again, and it's a renewed sense of self, but it's also the resilience that comes back and kicks on. Having that, it's something that I don't think anybody could take away again. It'll waver, of course. Like we talked, there's going to be days where I'm on it, and there's days where I'm like, that was not the best, not the worst, but not the best. I've definitely been in the pit. I've been worse places. There's something special to helping other women, especially, gain that sense of self, gain that confidence, and realize it's okay to set boundaries. It's okay to be disliked. It's okay to change your life and what you thought that you wanted and the person you thought you were going to be with, or the motherhood journey, to choose it or not. So there's so many different areas that confidence can come up. And then there's so many different areas that people have the opportunity to be assertive rather than passive aggressive or passive, and never state what they want or need, and then end up feeling resentful, or like we talked about, people pleasing. It is a form of manipulation. We want people to see us a certain way, but usually we're sacrificing what we really want deep down for the sake of being accepted, or so we think. And that doesn't always happen.
Exactly. I mean, you really hit the nail on the head with just, you know, unwavering confidence, but the ability to really hone in. And once we get to that level where we can start to manage it instead of feeling like it's out of control, but managing it where there's going to be days when you're on it and days you're going to waver. And there's going to be fleeting moments of self-doubt, insecurities, and questioning that enoughness, right? And I know that that's something you specifically talk about is really honing in and how to heal the not enoughness that really blocks you from living in a life of overflowing confidence, abundance, really feeling like you can get to that next level or that next chapter, even just taking that next step.
Yes.
Whatever that looks like. So yes. I'd love for you to share a little bit more about what that enoughness is, because I think that we all identify with that feeling internal. And maybe we don't have the word for it. Maybe we're still struggling, but there's that void. There's something in us that's saying there's got to be more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd be happy to speak to that. So when we're looking at where our psyche starts to develop, a theory that I like to reference is, I don't know why his parents named him this, but his name's Erik Erikson. Speaking of names that are easy to remember and spell, Erik Erikson's psychosocial theory of development states that there are different, and this has to be modified because when the theory was first created, lifespan wasn't as long as it is now, but the milestones, I think, still apply. So that's why I still reference it, that when we're looking at from infancy to through childhood, through adolescence, there are certain areas of growth that everybody goes through. Not everybody comes out the other side with the virtue, is what he calls it. So if you master that developmental level, you have the virtue. Others that don't master it feel kind of stuck. That's where the term arrested development comes from, that you're stuck at a certain life stage or life, not a literal age, but like the mental age of it, because either you weren't being helped in processing or some sort of really intense trauma happened that you weren't able to process and maybe still have not been able to. A part of you almost gets frozen at that age. So way back to infancy, which is my fascination, I would say, in analysis when I work with adults, what happened to you when you were little? And the first stage that we ever learn, ideally, how to be in the world is trust or mistrust. Were my parents there for me when I was a baby? Did they match my cries? Did they come to me and attend to me? Did they try to figure out what was going on in my life? And so that feeling of enoughness, in my view, stems from all the way when we're babies. Am I enough? Do I matter? Are my parents going to be there for me? It's the question we all ask ourselves from the time we're babies. Honestly, until adulthood, until we reach that phase of like, it's okay if they don't feel this way about me. I feel this way about myself. Then you kind of individuate away from your family. But for a long time, that's where our first feeling of acceptance comes from. So do we have that trust, or did our parents not attune to us? Do we not have that sense of trust either in self or in the world? And then we move through, it's kind of like chutes and ladders almost. We move through the rest of the developmental stages. Doesn't mean you can't go back and develop the trust. That happens with reparative relationships. But the rest of your trajectory working through like the next stage is like autonomy versus shame and doubt, then you have initiative versus guilt, and it works the you work your way up the milestones. So if you think about those, even those first three, if I have mistrust, shame and doubt and guilt, I'm probably not going to have the same psychological template as somebody who has trust, autonomy and initiative. It doesn't mean it just goes either way. You can have a little bit of each, but that's where the sense of enoughness really stems from, is in that's why those first 0 to 3, 0 to 5 years are so crucial for the way that you view yourself, the way that you view the world, and the way that you view your work. Is this all I'm good for is often a question that clients that I work with come in of like, why do I feel like I'm not enough for somebody I know I'm better than? And they're not trying to be egotistical. They're trying to say like they're very accomplished, educated doctors and lawyers, and they're, you know, struggling over their high school sweetheart who never left their hometown and never graduated high school. So like on paper, definitely one is more advanced than the other, but they're feeling like, why does this person have this hold over me? Part of us didn't develop to think that we were worth all that we are, or we developed a sense of that our worth was based on productivity. And then if that's the case, nothing will ever be enough, because there's almost, on the cognitive brain, there's unlimited amounts you could produce. But on the physical side of things, there's limited amounts of energy you have to actually create those things. So that's where this balance needs to be struck of my worth is not based on my productivity. And even if it were, this is enough for today. This is enough for this month. This is enough for this year, whatever you accomplish. Women have a different sense of time because of our hormonal cycles. And we don't view time as 24-hour clocks. It's month by month. So that's also why we feel like we can never get anything done, and we have to get everything done all in one day. Or if you talk to a guy, they're like, oh, I didn't get the laundry done today, I'll just do it tomorrow. But for us, we're like, but then that throws off this and this and this. And there's so many things that are contingent upon that to-do list. That's part of understanding yourself more, that it let it be enough. And if it's not enough today, then try it again tomorrow. Having more of that self-compassion and grace and understanding starts to build up and fill in the holes of where you feel like you're not enough.
I love that you differentiate between the two, because we do tend to see that, especially, you know, in our whole relationships, if we're married or have our partners, and we tend to see like, well, one does it this way and one does it the other way. And then sometimes that the inaction, we use the laundry, for example, can deep them on our self-worth. Like, why also couldn't he get it done? Because does he not value me? Because yeah, we perceive that production as a part of us, right? Yeah. And so I'm curious to know like how that translates then into other relationships, which we kind of just talked about briefly right there, but I love how you broke it down. And it's so simple. And, you know, you take something so complex and simplify it so that we can actually see how it's impeding in our everyday lives, like how it's showing up, where it's at. And it's not just living in our mental bandwidth space, because it's showing up in our actions and how we interact with others into relationships. But really, before we go, okay, you tell me, where do you want to start on that? Do we want to talk about how it affects others, or how it's actually affecting us first?
This answer might cover both. So let me know. If not, we can go in either direction. So the reason, or the way that they're both connected, is our internal comparison meter. That's a term I just made up. That like internal clock, or that internal meter of like, what is enough, what is not enough. And not even in terms of self-worth, but like when a task is done, or what I gave my students the example, like what is on time? And I'd have 45 students about per class, and I would get, you know, 10 here being like 5 minutes early. And then 10 people are like, as when the time of it starts to say 10 a.m., they're like at 10 a.m. And then the rest of them would be like, oh, it starts when I get there, or I'm lucky if I make it after the 15 minute mark. So not everybody has the same operational definition. So to your question of how it affects us and how it affects others, we compare, women especially, compare other people. We compare other men to what a woman would do, and we compare other women to what the perfect woman would do. So it affects it in the sense that I can see myself, but then I get down on you, or I'm frustrated with you because I could have done it. Why can't you? It's almost like this contempt and criticism, but often women are not intending it to be contempt or criticism. They are struggling with this. They want to be free of this idealized perfect person who's like this punitive, in psychoanalysis, like a punitive superego that's the inner critic of like, it's never enough. You're never going to be good enough. You must produce more. because the perfect person would. The perfect doesn't exist. So not only do we need to capture that internally, like your book, obviously Chasing Perfection, perfect doesn't exist. We can't expect that of ourselves, and we can't project that onto others if we happen to fall short, inevitably, of perfection. And the reason why we project it onto others, I believe, is because deep down, we want everyone to be rescued from it. Like, we want to be free of it entirely. So it's like the women I work with who are hyper-independent. Well, it's not that I want to be in the driver's seat all the time, but I just want somebody to be in the driver's seat. And if nobody's in there, then of course I'm going to have to sit in it. So they have to learn then to like get out of the car metaphorically and wait and see who comes into the driver's seat that's not them. And that's where it also affects our relationship with ourselves and others, because we have a certain ideal of how we like things done, when we like things done, in what way they get done, by when they get done. And those are, if they're not voiced expectations, that can lead to a lot of frustration. But it can also lead to a lot of joy, because I'm sure you've had a friend where they are a similar style to you in one way. And you're like, oh my gosh, this feels so good. We get along in this way. You gravitate naturally more towards people who you don't have to explain yourself to. Because again, back in infancy, when we didn't have words, we just had tears to get our needs met. It all goes back to romantically and platonically, that internal desire to be known in a way that we don't even have to ask, which is from our infant mother, usually relationships, where that was pretty much the only time of our life that's going to come true. And even for others, it didn't come true all the time. But like, obviously, a baby cannot ask for things. It can only like emote, and then the mother has to decipher it. And that's when the baby's like, they get me. Like, they understand me. They're attuned. We bring that with us into adulthood. So that's like the circular answer, meaning it covers, I try to draw a circle around both. That's how it affects our relationships with ourselves and other people.
I love that. And you're spot on with that as well. It's like, I mean, I resonate with so much of what you're sharing. You know, I quote unquote, well, am a recovering perfectionist. But it was wild because as I was writing my book, I never even knew that I was chasing perfection, because sometimes as a perfectionist, you don't even realize it, because you were just conditioned to perform or produce. Yes. And that was a way for you to be noticed, to be seen, to be a sense of achievement, because the more I produce, I get recognized. And, you know, typically if we look at career status, every time I performed, I got a promotion. What comes with promotion? Increase in pay. So it was just, now became a game. I was like, oh, I wonder what level I can get to. And it was like, it felt like a video game sometimes until I got to the highest tier in my former career. After being there for almost 10 years, that I capped out, I hit a ceiling in there and became this stagnation and almost like this resentment was like, oh, this sucks. This is all there is. And then, you know, I start working for myself and obviously the sky's the limit. But then I become my own worst critic because I know what I'm capable of.
Yes.
And then there's like time. You think, what did they say? You can get, where you underestimate and overestimate time at the same time, where it's like,
yes,
what you can do, what you think you can get done in 5 minutes is what you can do in 5 months. I butchered it.
I know the one you're thinking.
Sure, you know what I'm talking about.
Yes, we don't have that relation. We overestimate the things that I'm going to butcher it too, but we overestimate the things that actually we don't need to overestimate. But then we think that something, this big undertaking, is going to take forever. And then we start it. We're like, oh, that only took 10 minutes. Like, I thought that was going to take 5 months. Yeah, it's the what we think is going to take 5 minutes can actually take 5 months. And then what we think is going to take 5 months can take 5 minutes, like, especially with the career. Big ideas or like launching a podcast, it honestly doesn't. The sustaining of it takes a long time, I would say, and effort. But to just get a microphone, Zoom, and submit it to Spotify for podcasters, like, it doesn't have to be perfect. That's all it takes. But people build it up because they see this eventual result of what they want it to look like. And they think the first iteration of when they do something has to be this perfect end goal. It takes a long time to not make something perfect, but to perfect something. So if you have a skill or you have an expertise, it takes hours and years and days all at the same time, living into that and eat, sleep, breathing it. It's not really about, I like to teach about the difference, the two different kinds of time. Greek mythology is the Chronos, which is chronological time, 24-hour clock, and Kairos, spelled Chiros. That's the felt sense of time. That's your relationship with like, this hour is going by so quickly. But if you had a guest or I had a guest that we didn't really vet properly, or maybe was having an off day, or if you've ever met with a friend that you're like, oh, it's like obligatory family holidays where you have to see the person, same amount of chronological time, not the same felt sense of time. So we also underestimate that felt sense of time. It's like, it's going to take a while. That's why a while, very general, not a chronological or Kairos timing to it. It'll take a while before it feels like you've perfected something. That could be a month for me. It could be a week for you. That's why we can't compare to other people. Everybody has a different operational definition and relationship with both chronological and Kairos time.
Wow. I didn't realize that. I never looked at it that way, because it is true. And it's funny because how, like, if I'm telling time, I always go back to some chronological. There's always like some timeline. And of course, I throw on my ADHD brain. So yep. Every detail is super important. So yep. It has to be like, how are you today? I don't have to like take you all the way back to like what happened last year or something like that, that led up to here. Mm-hmm. So, you know, sometimes yes. But I always make my point known. But I've never looked at the other one. Was it? How do you think?
Kronos and then Kairos, Kairos.
Okay. I've never thought about that. And that's how we perceive time in ourself for production or management of time, right?
Yeah, in part, or just the felt sense. It's just defined as felt sense of time. So it could be like in a relationship, for example, or a friend. That's why that theory of friendships of like, you could meet somebody in 1 year who made you feel that what you never felt in 20 years, whatever. That's, again, not about chronological time. It's about that felt sense. And the more, the later in life that you meet someone, friend or romantic partner, the more likely you are to hit it off or not right away, because you ideally know yourself more. You've had more chronological and experienced time on earth. So you're not willing to put up with as much BS as when you're young and everybody's like, you have your whole life ahead of you. Maybe, maybe not. That person could unfortunately meet their end the next day. You don't know. Like, that's not a safe thing to tell someone. Like, you have the rest of your life ahead of you. Okay, but what if you don't? And what if you tell that person in their relationship, like, okay, I'm only 20. I know it could be better, but I'll just spend 10 years in this dead end relationship. And then by 30, like, time is the one resource you can't get back and you can't make more of. So regardless of the actual chronological sense or the felt sense, that when you lean into it, go for the felt sense. Like, you can kind of disregard the chronological sense of time, because you can really work towards something. And like, I don't really love the quote, we all have the same 24 hours in the day, because as a mother, I can tell you, no, we do not. Like, we definitely do not. I would love an extra 8 hours from somebody else. I wish time worked like that Justin Timberlake movie where you could like, whatever, they like drug deals time with their wrists. We do not have the exact same amount of time, or we have the same amount of time, but we don't have the same felt sense of time or the same energy reserves. So thinking of it in that sense of what does this feel like, then you can start to base your productivity or what is enough based on, do I feel in my somatic body like that was enough time? I go to yoga sometimes, and at the 35, 40 minute mark, I don't bring my phone in, but just internally in my body, I'm like, I'm done. Like, I don't care if the class goes till 60 minutes. My body is done at 40 minutes. That's when you tune more into that felt sense, the feminine, if you will, if you're into the energetics of things. That's where women can start to not overproduce as a way to get self-worth. And I'm enough as I am, and start to believe that. Oh, that was enough. It's like willpower with eating. I have a few bites of dessert. When it starts to taste for me like it's just any other food, then I stop, because that wasn't the purpose. The purpose was me enjoying the dessert. As soon as it just turns into, I have to finish this because I have to, I don't want to do that. So learning to hone in your own willpower and letting what feels good or feels like enough be enough. Obviously, ideally working with like a therapist or a mentor to help you, because I know people listening are like, nothing ever feels like it's enough. That's where having a guide helps you to be like, okay, here are the parameters, and then we'll work backwards with your feelings.
Right. Yeah. Because sometimes there are days like that where it just feels like time just slips and you wonder like, oh my God, why am I like still stuck on the same comprehensive like math problem? I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's kind of like test taking days back in the day. It's like tick, tick, tick. All you hear is the sound of the clock ticking, and you're like still stuck on the same thing. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it could feel like Groundhog Day over and over and over again. So it's like, I guess I never, like, going back to that, I hadn't realized that sense of self, how we determine time. But then to your yoga example, I mean, I even feel myself actually right on that example. I'll go to my yoga class, but I'm like, okay, around about 40 minutes. Mm-hmm. My mind has already checked out.
Yes.
And then I'm just like, okay, what do I do for these next 20 minutes? Because I don't want to be the person that has to get up, but I usually slip my mat at the end of the door. But because you have to also honor and respect that that's your time as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is quite interesting. I hadn't really considered those thoughts. And I do love psychology. That was my major in college was marketing with a minor in psychology. But then since I had a few transfers there and there,
yes,
I was all chalked up under business studies. I was like, all right.
Yeah. Yes.
But psychology has always fascinated me because I always wanted to know how not only I thought, but why others do what they do.
Yeah.
And then she tying into consumer behavior and then the psychoanalysis and understand a deeper dive into the human behavior, not just like the processes of buying as a consumer behavior. So how do we do what we do? And it always stems, like you said, back to childhood. But I've even recognized even in conversation, some people don't go that far because they feel like that's not where the foundation is.
What do you mean? It's when I was a kid, I'm like, you're right. Let's just write off the literal most important years of your life for everything. You're right. And who you choose in adulthood, it's nothing to do with the relationship you saw your parents have or not have growing up. What do I know? I just dedicated 15 years to my, like, it is interesting to me how much people can have that cognitive dissonance.
Yeah.
And then obviously if they were to go to therapy, they'd realize like, oh, and I'm like, yeah, you avoided it for so long because you knew it was going to mess your stuff up if you had to really look at it. And they're like, yeah, like sometimes ignorance is bliss. Truly. Like you can't unlearn what you never wish you knew. So be careful. Like use in moderation. Do the self-help work in moderation because there are some things that you can't unsee and you can't unlearn and it will change. Like this time thing is probably something you'll take with you for here until whenever. And because there's things that you learn that are so profound at times that make such an impact, you can't help but take it with you. That can go for both positive and negative. So be mindful of if you're starting a self-help journey to be more confident who you're working with because they might have a different vision in mind. Timeline wise, not chronological, but like, here's all the things we're going to cover. And if you're not ready to go, I talked to a client about this recently. They were mentioning they'd worked with a therapist previously that they weren't ready to go where the therapist was ready to go. And then sometimes the client's ready to go where the therapist isn't and they can't take them there. Be very mindful that you have an ideal match for what work you're trying to do so that you can actually get to the destination seemingly unscathed. Less scathed than you were when you came in, I guess. Like no more scathed than when you came in.
Right. Okay. So how in your opinion, how important is it to actually go all?
That is a good question. My answer would be it is dependent on at least two factors. First factor being how many areas of your life are you noticing what you're trying to work through be affected by. So some people come in and the job is on lock, the friendships are on lock, the travel, the what have you, they're just missing the relationship, right? That I call them, they're like, I have everything I want in my life except someone to share it with. And for those clients, it's important to go back to their younger years, but more so in terms of the specific topics. So I want to know about your parents' relationship. I want to know how conflict was for you growing up. So we still go back in time, but we may not go back and do like, okay, and then your teachers and your friends and your sports and your this. We're going back to one specific area. So that's like one answer. And then the other part of it is, so like, it depends on how many areas of your life are impacted by what you're wanting to come into therapy for. And the other answer is, How much are you willing to have almost every relationship in your life change? And that's sometimes a question that people are like, and I'm like, that's the price. That's the price of admission if you're going to do the deep work in therapy. It doesn't mean we need to go all the, like, I don't go to their first day on earth that they remember from our first session. Like, I'm not that mean, but we will go there eventually. And so it's like, how willing are you to see the world in a totally different lens? Like, I joke on my coaching application when people want to work with me, I'm like, colors will look different. Food will taste different. I'm like, just kidding. But you will have a different outlook on life. And so I like to use humor, obviously, because I think it tempers a lot of that deep work and the discomfort. it allows you to digest it. It's like a Tums. Like humor is like the Tums of psychology. It allows you to digest it more easily. So you can have your favorite foods and the spice and like go as hot as you want, but you're going to need something to settle your stomach afterwards because it can be pretty revealing when you go to therapy and you realize sometimes it's like, oh, my own self-sabotage patterns are why this happened. Some people have a history of experiences in their life where they were unfortunately put in the victim position. And sometimes that stems from their own family system putting them in the victim position. So then they like recapitulate it in their adult relationships. And sometimes people put themselves in the victim position and don't realize it and blame others. And then they have to hold themselves accountable in therapy. Both are uncomfortable discoveries. It's, again, very important that you have somebody that you can trust, that you feel safe, that can help you repair that. So you can take what you get from therapy and employ it in the rest of your life and feel like you are enough.
Right. And to your kind of humor about things will taste and look different and color different. That is true. But that's the bonus of coming down at the other end.
Yes.
Like it was, I remember taking deep dive in, and I always thought, so when I started therapy, it was just very superficial because I was like, I just want to fix this area of my life.
Yes.
Until I realized that area of my life was greatly impacting several other areas because I couldn't go to the depths of where I wanted it to go.
Right, right.
And I needed to go to the depths of my own inner work to really find out what is holding me back. Mm-hmm. And, you know, therapy is really as far deep and as far wide as you want to go.
So true.
But I think that it's one of those, enter at your own risk and be cautious about it. But knowing that ahead of time makes you more curious to see how much further you can explore, because when you start seeing things turn out better, and I say better because meaning your awareness will shine light on areas that you didn't know otherwise. And you might go in thinking you have a great relationship, but all of a sudden the inner work is like, ooh, that's actually a really toxic, like that's, I don't know if I could sustain that for long. So it changes the way you see things, but it doesn't mean that those individuals that are in your life are like bad people or they're like before you. It's just now it's more of an self-empowerment for you to take the depths and the ratings back in control of your own, which if you think about what a perfectionist is, they're craving power and control in a life that feels out of control because they haven't managed what wasn't brought to the surface to manage.
Correct. And it feels unsafe and chaotic to not have, again, someone, usually me in the driver's seat, but someone in the driver's seat. And it's like, okay, but the car doesn't have to be moving all the time. Like there's an option for you to park the car, get out of the car, and then no one needs to be in the driver's seat. I'm not advocating for people to let their car go on autopilot. We've even seen actual cars that are self-driving not be able to do well. Like don't just let it go on autopilot, but just pull over. Find a rest stop, metaphorically in your mind, pull over whatever level you can stomach and park the car and get out. And then that need for control, right? That's where like growth happens outside your comfort zone. But knowing the boundaries on your comfort zone is the key to that, because otherwise it's just this boundless growth all the time. And then when you stop to slow down, you're like, oh, whoa, this is unsafe. I've never slowed down. I don't know what it's like to just be. All of the clients that I work with, I rarely use the absolutes of like always and never. I'll leave room for error. Most every single client I've ever worked with does not have a comfort or a knowing of how to just be, how to receive, how to be in the receptive position, because they've either been conditioned by society, their family, or a mix of both. An intrinsic knowing of this is where my work comes from. I will just do for everybody else. And whatever, if I have anything left over, will be given to me, which is usually not a lot. And that keeps them in that chasing position, like we talked about. If you have a cup and there's a bunch of holes in the bottom of it, doesn't matter how much other people or you pour into yourself, you don't have a solid foundation. Sometimes that's your own doing, meaning somebody brought something to your attention and you chose not to go to therapy over it. And sometimes it's not your own doing. Your parents can't give to you what they couldn't or didn't have for themselves or couldn't give to themselves. So they don't know how to bolster your self-worth. They don't, that sense of I'm enough as I am does come from secure attachment and feeling that in childhood. It doesn't mean you can't learn a parallel of that in adulthood with corrective emotional experiences. It's your job to seek them out. And that's the line of like, it might not have been your fault, but your healing is your responsibility. Doesn't mean it's going to be easy. That does not abdicate the person of it. There's going to be no pain. Like there will be some pain involved. There's loss involved. Do you have a support system that can get you through that? that can get you through the inevitable fear of like, okay, I'm letting go of control. What if something happens? And I will go there with my clients. I'm like, we're going to spend 5 minutes in your own mental health. Let's go there. They're like, what? I'm like, we're doing it. They're like, wait, no. I'm like, no, we are. For 5 minutes, you can stomach it. I'm not going to let you like leave here without it, like without feeling contained at the end. And I'm like, and then what would happen? And then what would? And then what would? And I take them and then like, and oh, I guess some of them are like, oh, I guess it wouldn't be that bad. And then some of them are like, and then I'm going to die. And I'm like, okay, but what's the likelihood that that's actually going to happen? They're like, probably pretty slim. And I said, so the fear is very valid. The likelihood or the outcome of that happening, maybe like 1%, right? Like, why spend so much time in your life worrying about what is maybe 1% going to happen? Like the death thing, like very rarely is that the ultimate thing of like, I'm going to do this and I'm going to die. Like step two, just there's no in between. And they laugh and they're like, okay, yeah, that makes more sense. And I was like, that's the anxiety part of your brain trying to keep you alive, but doing too good of a job. It's giving you like paralysis. So yes, we need to work backwards from there and learn to just,
it's okay.
Mistakes are okay. Imperfect action is better than no action some of the times, but then other times, if nothing comes clear, then no action's the better action to take. So learning to look at the world differently and look at yourself differently lets you off the hook from feeling like everything has to be perfect and projecting that onto others if you fall short.
Right. It's almost like I kind of have like this visual come to mind about all these tea kettles about to boil at the same time, and you're trying to manage all of them, and you're like, you pull one off, the other one's gone, yep, but the other one's hot, and it's like it's frantic all over. So it's like, we know that we can't manage everything all the same time and manage them well, which then could impede on our like, what is wrong with me? Why can't I do this? Why am I so stupid? Why can't I figure it out? Everyone else, like, you know, Miss Susie Homemaker can figure it out, but what about me? And mm-hmm, we can put on that narrative. And of course, these are just,
yeah,
you know, big examples. Yeah. But you brought up another point that I'd like to just kind of tangent off of here, yeah, for a moment. Attachment styles. Can we talk about
that? Yes. Yes. How deep do you want me to go?
However long you want to go.
And okay.
Just wide
and, as wide and deep. So attachment styles, depends on who you ask. If you want to learn more, a really good book that I recommend to all my clients and anybody on social media, it's called A Secure Base by John Bowlby. He's the father of attachment. And attachment theory is what it gets convoluted on social media now. And like, attachment styles are fluid. I'm in that camp, but I'm also in the camp of knowing analytically, you get what you get in childhood. So it's like, both and. It's the quality and care that you either did or didn't receive from your primary caregiver. Back in the day, it was mother. Like any paper that you read analytically, it's always mother as primary caregiver. So when you're looking at the quality of the attunement and the level of care and interest in the child or infant child's inner world, that is the foundation for attachment. Are you there for me when I need you? Are you able to decipher and attune to what needs that I have in infancy without me having to ask, in childhood and adulthood, or childhood and adolescence, it with me asking, but maybe not being direct, or maybe tantruming, or maybe that, because the brain's developing. So you have ideally developed adult brain trying to attune to and be near, psychologically near, a dysregulated, but learning how to be regulated, child and adolescent brain. And if especially the parent never got that themselves, they never received it, tough to give it, that's where misattunement can come from. So when you're looking at the ideal attachment style, it's secure attachment. And this, the bar is in health. The bare minimum is 30%. And this comes from analytic research. There's about 30% of the time, so a bid for connection, I cried and my parent knew to change my diaper. I cried. They knew that I was hungry. It literally takes about 30% of those times to have a secure base. So for a lot of us that are like, had insecure attachment, it's like, what? Like, did my parents mess it up that badly? Not necessarily, because coming off of infancy and childhood, those are not the only attachment figures that we have. So this is more of like the new age look at attachment theory. Those are not the only attachment figures we have. And our attachment system can be acted upon by others and by our family system. So you want the secure attachment. You want that sense of, I'm good enough. I trust myself. I trust people in the world. My needs will be met more often than not. And if they're not, I have the wants and needs and skills to vocalize that. It's like, secure attachment surmise. And what securely attached people look like in relationships, they are comfortable with closeness and they are comfortable with separation. They don't personalize either of the two. When you're looking at the insecure attachment styles, this is where we see that those needs and wants were more often than not met, which leaves the child to interpret, okay, I have to do everything myself and I don't want to get close to people because inevitably I'll be disappointed and hurt, avoidant attachment. And intimacy, either sexual intimacy or close emotional intimacy, closeness, feels like I'm going to get engulfed and feels like that's a threat to the autonomy and independence I had to develop to keep myself alive growing up. I will kind of try to get, I want you next to me, but not close to me. So it's like at love at arm's length. The other type, there's a third of the insecure, but I'll get to that in a second. The other type we commonly see is the anxious attachment, which is I learned that I wasn't going to get my needs met. And so now I'm frantically trying to get it met. I didn't take the defensive position of I'll just do everything myself. It's I'm going to put it on you. You're going to fail a test you don't know you're taking. I'm going to need a lot of closeness as the threshold to feel like I'm enough, to feel like we're close and intimate. And sometimes it's too much for the other person. That doesn't mean the anxiously attached person is too much. It's simply that the wants and the needs are surpassing the threshold that the other person's able to give. And the anxiously attached person often struggles with low self-worth and low self-esteem because they personalize, this person isn't choosing me. They're not attuned to me. They don't want to spend time with me. They must not love me. I must be unlovable. And then this negative cycle is internalized. And then you can have the third one, which I call the combo pack of both anxious and avoidant attachment, which is called disorganized attachment, which often stems from severe childhood neglect or abuse, that the people who are supposed to keep you safe are the very people hurting you and abusing you. It's very confusing for the child mind psychologically. I've worked with numerous clients who've had this, and this is not to say that this is the only way, again, disorganized attachment can come about. It most often comes about when there is severe abuse, where the child cannot mentalize, why is my mom or my dad, who I'm attuned to biologically and I'm going to for my needs met, hurting me? I've worked with clients who've had their fingers slammed in piano keys, who were dropped off at public areas and then picked up 2 days later. Like, we're talking severe abuse and neglect. And then they're wondering why in adulthood they can't love, why they can't find a successful relationship, why they can find one, but they can't sustain one. This is where I say, like, this is the hill I will die on. Like, this is where it does stem from childhood, because your adult romantic relationships are the closest thing in emotional intimacy wise to your familiar relationships. If you think about it, like, friendships can come and go. You could end a friendship without, it's not, they hurt, but it's not necessarily the same thing as like the pressure that especially Western America puts on the primary family, the one partner. They have to be your everything. They're not going to be your everything. So if you can come to terms with that, the attachment and attunement gets easier. But what about when they're not the things that they are supposed to be? Like, they're not supposed to be everything to you, but of the things they are supposed to be, what if happens when they fall short with those? That's also where we see attachment styles flare up. So if I'm avoidant and my partner needs too much from me, I'm going to pull away because I feel like I am not capable of giving them that, which makes me touch against my not enoughness. And I'd rather avoid that. So I'll just avoid it entirely. Or I might want a ton more from my partner and they hit a threshold where they're like, I can't give you what you need. You're asking for too much. The literal sentence, you're asking for too much, does not need to translate to I'm too much for everybody and I'll never find love. But that's often the case for that, again, scared inner child. I just wanted my parents to care about what I cared about. I wanted to go to them and show them my painting, but they were always busy, or they were always fighting, or they were always doing something else and I didn't feel important. Childhood matters. Like, I tell parents, I am a parent. I tell parents this all the time. Like, your kids only get one childhood. And I'm not saying this to like scare them into it, but there is an appropriate amount of pressure that does need to be put on parents to undo or relearn what they did not like about their childhood, so it doesn't come out sideways on their kid. I thought, this is about attachment as well, I knew how important it was that I was both so impressed by it and so afraid of it, I didn't want to mess it up. And then when I started the journey of like, okay, I think I could do parenthood. I feel like I'm ready in my life. It's a big undertaking. I want to be focused for it. I've accomplished everything I wanted to in my career. Like, at that time, I got the news from my endocrinologist. They're like, well, it looks like you're infertile. So I started counseling to go to grief counseling of like, I never wanted to be a mom because I was afraid of how bad I'd mess it up. Not because I think I was bad at it. I was just so impressed by it. I didn't want to get up. So then I went to grief counseling. Turns out that I was not infertile and I was not trying to, at that point, was not trying to get pregnant, but ended up getting pregnant. So it was a surprise. So it went from like the agony of, I don't think that I'll be a mom, to I was a mom without even trying. So it was all in a matter of 6 months that I'm like going through this in counseling. So my own relationship with my family came up and I worked with it like an attachment-based psychoanalyst who was helping me understand this is triggering to you because this is likely what happened in your own childhood. And there was times where I would feel trapped here. And I'm like, it took me back to the time I was two and my parents didn't get me out of the car seat fast enough. Like all of those blips on what we think are blips as adults can become children's core memories that they base life decisions off of. So again, I'm not saying it for listeners to pressure them of like, you have to be perfect as a parent. You will not be perfect as a parent. You do have to, though, make those repair attempts and attune. She's 5 months old. I will apologize to her because sometimes I have to like leave her in the car seat and then put the dog in the house and then come back out and get her. It's like 30 seconds, but to her, it feels like eternity. And I hold her. I said, I'm sorry. I know that was probably traumatizing for you. I am here. I didn't mean to cause you that upset. Like, I can have those adult-like conversations with her from when she's a baby. So it's normal for her, where so many parents wrote it off like, you were just a kid. You'll get over it. Probably not. And I had a whole practice full of adults who were told as kids to get over it. And I'm here to tell you they didn't get over it. They're still under it. So, yeah.
It's like, yeah. Remember that time I was two? It's like, yes. Yeah. That was like 1,000 years ago. Get yes. over it.
Yeah.
Like, but the fact that you're still bringing it up.
Yes. Means,
hey, you haven't gotten over it.
Yes.
It's still weighing heavily in some period of your life.
Yes. Yeah.
I love that you brought that up in the different attachment styles, the not enoughness, and really how this pulls all together about our confidence of like how we perceive ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
So our perceived value of worth mm-hmm. and what we think that we are value or what our value is that we can bring into relationships. So let's pull this all together and tell how, you know, how confidence relates to business, how it relates to dating, to our friendships, our platonic, our partners, all these relationships, including the relationship that we have with ourselves.
So how I like to define confidence is not that you know everything. It's that you're comfortable and self-assured and confident talking about what you do know. And you're open to learn more. And you're also open to admit or voice when you don't know something. So it's like that comfort zone, but growth zone all in the same circle. And deeper than that, that sense of confidence is a self-assuredness. I am enough as I am. And the moments that I don't feel like I am enough, I trust. And that's where that key, that first foundational developmental milestone, I trust that I can either attune to myself or attune to part of my support system to try to get that want or need met. That might look like reaching out to a friend to hear like, hey, I'm having kind of a low day. Could you share a few of your favorite things about me or our friendship? It would really help, right? We all need that confidence boost at times. So let's say I feel like I'm not a good friend. I would look for evidence that I am a good friend. And that balance of there's somebody else's opinion of me, does not necessarily mean that is the opinion I have to have of myself or that is the opinion that I have to believe is true. Other people's opinions are based on their own projections, their own life experiences, and a lot of times their own dashed expectations. You're a bad friend because you didn't do this thing that you didn't know I secretly wanted you to do, but I blinked at you once the last time we hung out, and how could you not interpret it? Because if you were a real friend, then you would have known without me having to ask. And think about how much that ties back into that statement. I shouldn't have to ask. You should just know stems from infancy where, again, the expectation was my parent didn't have to ask. I didn't have to ask. They did just know. We can't translate that directly into adulthood. So confidence looks like in all areas of our relationships. I know who I am. And if you don't know who you are, go on the journey for self-discovery. And the more that you know who you are, the more that you know who you'll be a good fit for and who you won't be a good fit for, and you're not going to take it personal. That's the other piece of confidence that I teach my clients. As much as we want to feel important, that means a lot of the times we make things about us that aren't about us, and we don't make enough about us that actually is about us. We can't take compliments. We can't ever receive an accolade. Nothing's ever good enough. Yet on the other side of this, we're chasing all of these that we talked about that on this on the other episode, but the external validation, that you can only chase external validation so much. If you don't have that foundation of how to validate yourself, it's not going to translate. It's just going to go right through. So you have to look at the internal validation skills of confidence as well. It's the self-assuredness, it's the ability to validate yourself, and it's the ability to admit when you're wrong. Like, hey, I cited this statistic. Whoops, that wasn't the right one. Rather than sitting there and trying to passionately defend an untrue point for ego, like, that doesn't get anybody help. It's really knowing, like, here's who I am, here's who I'm not, and here's this middle ground who I don't really know yet, but I'm excited for the journey. And when I'm not excited, I will reach out to my support system to help me go the distance. I often refer to my clients as hermit crabs. And when I say this, people are like, what? But I will explain, hermit crabs have a shell and they outgrow the shell at times. And that run, truly, it's a run marathon from the one shell that they just outgrew to the shell that's big enough for them is the most vulnerable run of their life, because they could get eaten by a bird, they could get washed away. You want to have people who can help. Like, I tell them I'm the hands guiding. Like, I'm not going to force you into the shell, but I will be that support system, an umbrella, if you will, while you make that most vulnerable run of your life. And then you get in the new shell and you're like, okay, oh, this is kind of nice. I have space for my legs. I can do this. Like, that's the constant growing that we all should, I don't use that word often, but would benefit from, it's a better way to put it, that we would all benefit from doing in our life. Like, move to the next shell. Don't just stay and complain or feel like you are trapped in a shell that's too small for you. Do the vulnerable run, go to the next shell, and leave yourself that wiggle room for growth, and be okay that you might not feel like you're in the driver's seat.
I love that. I love that you just painted like a whole picture, and we brought everything, the whole conversation, to a full circle. So I said, everything will always come full circle. I sound like a whole bunch of tangents, but they connect.
Nope, it all comes true. Yeah.
Yes. Oh my goodness. Like, seriously, you're like putting some like gas in my brain flames here.
Awesome.
Things that I can talk about all day, every day. Like, I love these conversations. Obviously, I'm like, part of me is kind of disappointed, but maybe that's not the right word, that I didn't get to do the things that I wanted to do in college because of all the different transfers that I had in my college year. So I went to four different schools in my 5 years, but it's always been such an area of fascination for me, that and philosophy, because I love the intricacies of how things interconnect, but beyond just what we see. And to your point, when you ask your clients, you're like, about fear, is it really? So you're going down these multi layers.
Yeah.
Because we tend to only get to one or two layers, and that's where our reasoning and rationale comes from. Mm-hmm. But if we actually go the extra steps, we can now see how it colors so many different things in our lives. It really does hit home, because that home is really the fear that our enoughness, and somebody had said this, I forgot who it was, but our greatest fear is that we will not be enough, because if we are not enough, that means we are not loved, and we are all craving love. We all want love.
Yep.
But everybody colors love differently. Love could just be as simple as spending that QT time, you know, like quality time there. It's like, okay. But love can also be the way that somebody holds you in that embrace, right? So they have the five love languages, but I feel like there's multiple or more.
Five.
But it's just to that point, because there's this, going back to childhood, if our needs are not met, that means we are not lovable, and parents didn't love us enough. That stems the enoughness. Mm-hmm. Man, this has been such a great conversation.
I'm glad. I love. I could talk about this for hours. So I hope your listeners enjoy it too. And I apologize in advance if any of you are like, "Thank you, I now need therapy."
Yeah, and we don't laugh at that in that way. But the whole point in these episodes are really to help inspire, encourage, and empower our listeners to really see things differently, see themselves differently. Go tackle something big that maybe you had felt that you weren't capable of, but we're just giving you ideas and stories and parables and just different ways that you could see what we're bringing to these episodes into your life. And if they're applicable, great. And if they're not, then move on to the next one. Like, we realize that not every single one is going to be something for everybody. But anyway, to carry on, how could people learn more about you and the works that you do? And, you know, people kind of got a little tidbit of what it's like to work with you, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So other ways to connect. I have podcasts where it's like similar ideology, I guess. So like the vibe, if you like this kind of conversation, similar conversations on the podcast that I have. It's one is Heal Through Humor. And then the other one is Between Two Clinicians. And then I did have a podcast called The Couples Guide, but we just retired that after 5 years. All the episodes are still live. If you want to go back and binge them, I think there's like 120 something of them. That's specifically for like couples therapy, relationships, and dating. So those are ways to work with me indirectly, I guess you could say. Learn from me without me being the teacher. And then I have individual coaching and therapy if you live in California. And I also teach a class, which is like a blend of both worlds. I talked to you about it off air because I was very irritated with how much self-help knowledge is being spewed about social media with like no verification and no, it's catchy on TikTok. So people are like, oh, well, I sleep with my arms like this, so I must have this diagnosis, right? So I'm like, okay, first of all, nobody should have given anybody who didn't have a license to DSM, but that's a different episode for a different day. So I compiled 10 plus years of the research and psychometric assessments and all of the lessons I taught as a professor in a self-help course. It's like a self-led self-help course called Rewire Your Relationships. And I have live lessons in there. So you have all of the data, which I love the research side of things because it gives you actual data and you can retake those year after year to see your growth. And then you get lessons from me. And then if you want to dive any more deeply into those topics, then you can do like a one-off coaching session. I find that a lot of clients, they knew a lot of this material, but they didn't know it to the depth that the class goes into it. And it wasn't all in one place, neatly compiled. And I feel like that is, at certain levels, that is what you pay for when you make an investment in self-help. You're not necessarily paying for the information. You're paying for that I or whoever you're buying it from has spent 10, 15 years doing their own work, their own life, their own research, and we can consolidate it. You're paying for the skill to be able to consolidate it, and you don't have to spend 10 or 15 years of your own time. Like, that's why people make the investment. That's why I suggest they make the investment in self-help when they're ready to do that. And there's, like we talked about, there's YouTube, there's free podcasts. If you don't want to make the monetary investment, you'll make the time investment. But eventually, again, time is the one thing you can't get back or make more of. Sometimes you do have to put the monetary investment in there to collapse time, is what I like to call it in my coaching, so you can actually get the results that you want faster without as much suffering.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So, and then your websites for both how to access is,
yes,
on or what?
Oh, yeah. So I have, my coaching is my name, Talia Bombola. I can give you the link to put in the show notes. And then if people want therapy, if you're a resident of California, then that's therapywithtalia.com. And then I'm most active on Instagram. That's just my first and last name. And I have all my offerings on there and my podcast too.
Awesome. So of course, all that will be in the show notes below. So be sure to connect with Talia. And if this episode resonates with you, be sure to reach out, let her know. Like, this is why we put out the content.
Yes.
So, you know, we never know whose ears it's hitting and whose lives it's impacting. So we love hearing from you guys. And of course, if you like it that much, leave us a review and share this episode as well. So thank you, Talia, just being here and just, oh my gosh, the expertise that you just poured all over our listeners. Thank you. Thank you for that.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Hey there. Thank you so much for joining me on today's episode of the Confident Woman Podcast. If you enjoyed today's episode as much as I did, please be sure to like, subscribe, and leave us a review. Thanks again for listening.